Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Short, sweet, and to the point.
I try my best,
sir. This is your first episode back since we went on break, so welcome back.
Thank you.
You have a good summer?
Yes. I'm keeping that short, sweet, and to the point.
This is going
format.
This is going nowhere, and there's already 59 minutes left to go on the show.
All right. Well, give me some content, and let's open this up.
All right. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the sci-fi drama Ad Astra. That will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including Crazy Rich Asians. There's a controversy behind the scenes as the one Asian American writer on the film is getting paid 1/10 the amount of her white male colleague for the sequel, to which we ask, really? And then Disney CEO Robert Iger in his new book said that Apple and Disney would have merged if Steve Jobs had lived. Did we dodge a bullet there? I mean, so to speak. Not to speak ill of the dead, but you know, finally, remakes. Why do they keep giving us so many remakes? But first, some other casting controversy, if you will, regarding Saturday Night Live. Shane Gillis was one of three new appointees, hires? What would you call them?
Hires, I guess.
All right. They weren't really appointed. But
although I'm the last person to ask about anything Saturday Night Live related, so.
When was the last time you think you watched a Saturday Night Live episode from beginning to end?
I don't think I ever have, but we were like forced to watch clips when I was in film school. It's just not something that I've ever found funny or ever will find funny.
So
I'm sorry.
You were forced to watch clips?
Yes. You know, as like an example of kind of the epitome of comedy, or at least that was probably the lesson or something.
No, you're right. I mean, it's, I think that's how most people digest Saturday Night Live now, is clips, is, you know, watching the stuff on YouTube after the fact. I don't think I've watched Saturday Night Live on TV since probably the turn of the century, or at least since like the Tina Fey days.
It just seems like it always has seemed like a gimmicky show. Like they take a celebrity, they put them in. Well, what do you mean? Oh, yeah. It's like, you know what I mean? Like the biggest show like on television. And I'm saying it's like also happens to be the dumbest one. Like how many Donald Trump impressions do you have to do before you like give up on that shtick?
Well, it's been a shtick they've been doing for 45 years.
Donald Trump?
Not Donald Trump, but like mocking the U.S. president. Like,
right.
Whether whether you're talking about Will Ferrell as George Bush, whether you're talking about Phil Hartman as Bill Clinton, or you're talking about Dana Carvey as Bush 41, or... I think
right. Just because it's a tradition doesn't mean it's been funny.
I mean, it goes all the way back to like Dan Aykroyd doing Nixon.
I'm saying that's right. So they've been running the same gag for the last like four decades. That's
anyway,
exactly it.
This is a new gag.
Right. Okay. So we have new writers.
Yes. Well, the new
one gentleman is cast. Embroiled in controversy.
Shane Gillis, who was hired as one of the new. Players. Mm-hmm. He comes from a stand-up comedy background, which is unusual because typically feeders for Saturday Night Live are things like Second City, mm-hmm. The Groundlings, like improv clubs, because that's kind of the nature of the beast. It's not really a venue for stand-up comics. Mm-hmm. But Shane Gillis may, you know, somebody quote-unquote dug up. I mean, you can't really say dug up because they were right there, but, you know, podcasts of him.
Right.
Using racial slurs about Asian people. And I think one of the things that makes this particularly bad is that the first Asian American cast member, the first Chinese, I think it's Chinese American, if we're getting like really, really specific, but one of the few Asian people who've ever been cast on Saturday Night Live was also hired at the same time as Shane Gillis, mm-hmm. Bowen Yang, which, you know, probably isn't helping your optics because it's been a... I mean, we're not necessarily fans, but this is, as you pointed out, it's a cultural thing. That it's
right.
Saturday Night Live is as much a cultural phenomenon than it is like a TV show now. It's on TV because it's been on TV for 45 years. And so it stands out that this is one of the few Asian people who have ever been hired to appear on the show.
Yeah. I mean, it seems fair. Like, it was egregiously out of place, and he was removed from the show as a result.
Gillis, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. This was not a James Gunn type thing where they, like you said, where they dug into his past and they were digging up something. It's like, you know,
they took a little step and their racial jokes were, or if you want to call them jokes, they weren't even jokes, I would say.
Yeah. So, you know, my problem is that now he's on Twitter going like, you know, say what you want. I was funny enough for Saturday Night Live. And like, you know, no one can take that away from me. I was always a Mad TV guy anyway and whatever. And it's like, no, excuse me. You did not contribute to Saturday Night Live at all. Your credits are not going in that show. You did not make anything. So why are you saying you are? You are a phony.
Well, I mean, think of all the people who've come and gone on Saturday Night Live over the years. And some of them have been like exceptionally funny. Like Norm MacDonald was fired from Saturday Night Live. I can't remember why. I've been trying to think why, and I haven't really bothered to do the research. But I remember one week Norm MacDonald was there, and then the next week he was gone. And I would probably say that Norm MacDonald is way funnier than Shane Gillis. I'm not really familiar with Shane Gillis's comedy other than the clips I've seen. But you're right. It's become a platform for him to, instead of, you know, looking hard at the jokes the quote-unquote jokes he made and why it lost him a Saturday Night Live gig, he's using it as a platform to promote himself.
Yeah, I know. If 20th Century Fox fired me from, like, a big studio movie, I would not be like, well, that's how the cookie crumbles, bro. Yeah. It's like, no, my career was just entirely, like, ruined, and I'm going to try and clamber back to... and let's be honest, it was totally distasteful. Like how hard is it to apologize for saying something so, unsavory? Yeah. Whatever you want to say.
Well, Shane Gillis is making it look pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Use that as an example of what not to do. There you go.
There was also the reporting, and I think it was from Variety, that said it was the decision of Lorne Michaels, or that Lorne Michaels was directed to find more conservative leaning comics, like people who are going to appeal to, I guess, Trump voters was the thing, which is kind of bizarre because I don't necessarily equate conservatives with humor, and I don't mean that like despairingly, but I mean the attempts at like quote-unquote conservative leaning humor over the years are things like the Daily Show, the right-wing Daily Show that the creators of 24 came up with, that if you can find clips of it at YouTube and see how remarkably unfunny it is.
Well I think there's one of the inherent skills of comedy is pulling yourself back from all of these cultural labels and being able to assess all of it from afar, like right wing, left wing. Any good comic is going to be able to just see the absurdity of like ultra whatever side you're on, you know what I mean? And comment on that. So I also find that kind of bizarre as well. But you know, whatever. It's like there's conservative and then there is just straight up like racist or bigotry or whatever.
Right. And I think those labels are getting confused too, that, you know, people are, when people like Shane Gillis get, you know, taken aback by people being outraged about their racist comedy, they come at it from the point of view of being quote-unquote edgy or being quote-unquote politically incorrect. And it's like, well, no, if you want to make a joke about Asian drivers, that's politically incorrect.
Right.
But the thing about those jokes is that they're jokes and they have a punchline to them. If, you know, the things he said on his podcast were like, you know, oh, C words, and by C word I mean the disparaging term for Asian people, can live in their dump, which, and his dump of course is meaning like New York's Chinatown.
Right.
then, you know, there's no joke to that. That's just straight up racism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think that's you being edgy. I think that's you sounding ignorant.
Like Doug Stanhope, like, does some very, like, edgy kind of stuff about, mm-hmm. you know, race and religion and stuff like that. But he, like, he digs on everybody, you know right. what I mean? And that's why it's kind of funny, because, like, nobody is spared from that, obviously. He's, like, tagging kind of everybody equally.
Right.
It's, so yeah. I find it kind of, like, it's fair ground, but he is obviously targeting, you know, very specific.
Yeah, racialized groups.
And it's not even like a joke, like you said. No. It's not even funny, you know what I mean?
It's a very fine line to, you know, if between like being an equal opportunity offender like George Carlin.
Yeah. And even what Dave Chappelle's doing right now, right? Like his newest like Netflix special was like super edgy. Like some of the jokes he said about like LGBTQ kind of stuff like that, mm-hmm. I thought was like very kind of like edgy. But yeah, I think we can agree that that's...
Well, and that's also him blatantly doing a bit. Mm-hmm. As opposed to what Shane Gillis was doing, which was like going on podcasts like right. this, where you're just talking to people.
Right.
You know, neither of us are kind of doing an act. And you know, podcasting is also a way, and this may be a lesson to comedians too, is that there are a lot of comedians who do podcasts as a way of, you know, enhancing their brand and like, you know, getting attention for themselves, because it's all about like putting your face or your mm-hmm. voice in as many places as possible. It's like this stuff will come back to haunt you,
yeah.
because you are putting it on the internet, and the internet is forever. And there's nothing wrong with like thinking twice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you may think something is edgy, but you may be wrong.
We've had this discussion on the show before about like, you know, how there's little like margin for error now,
yeah.
like how you kind of say things on the internet and now it's like kind of do or die. Like it could totally like jeopardize your career. And that is an interesting conversation. But this mm. is just strictly like
yeah.
they're removing a straight up like D-bag from their writing cast.
Right.
Like that's it. And people can say whatever, take a joke or whatever. It's like point out the joke. There is no joke.
That's yeah.
I'll laugh at the joke if it's funny, but like point out where the joke is.
Right. Well, this is no joke, which is they are developing a sequel to Crazy Rich Asians, which makes sense because there were three books in that series that mm-hmm. Kevin Kwan wrote. There were two screenplay writers on Crazy Rich Asians. One is Peter Chiarelli, and the other is Adele Lim. Guess which one is getting paid 1/10 less than the other? And this has been a controversy that Adele Lim left the project when it was revealed that she was making $110,000 to write the screenplay, while Peter Chiarelli was going to be making between $800,000 and $1 million. So,
well, I think before we get into it, we have to compare like their credentials, do we not?
Right.
Like,
well, I
is
mean,
is that not what that business is about? Like being paid according to your credentials?
That's an interesting point, because that was the argument of this studio of New Line Cinema, was that Peter Chiarelli is an experienced feature writer. Well, Adele Lim, I believe Crazy Rich Asians was her first feature screenplay. However, that's not to say she doesn't have writing experience. She has years and years and years of writing experience, but on television.
Right.
Which, I mean, and she's also done a lot of soaps, like One Tree Hill and Private Practice. And it's like, well, it seems like...
Well, to what degree is the other gentleman, like, more experienced then? Like, has
right.
he written more feature-length screenplays or something? Like, is he contributing more of the story and the adaptation of the book? Like,
well, that's...
These are nitty-gritty, I think, details that matter.
And that's something that I was thinking about myself, which is, okay, I just pulled up his writing credits. And before Crazy Rich Asians, he wrote Now You See Me 2 and The Proposal.
So those two, was there any television credits or anything?
Those are his only writing credits, is Crazy Rich Asians, Now You See Me 2, and The Proposal.
Yeah, so that seems a little...
Right, so yeah, it
that seems a little thin.
I could see if he was like somebody like David Knope,
right? Who
like everybody hires to
do their tentpole blockbuster,
do their polish,
or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, it does look like there is something of a discrepancy here. I'm going to call up Adele Lim's full IMDb while we're talking here, because I think if you probably compared apples to oranges, as it were, she probably has done like way more writing. Okay, so here is Adele Lim's full writing credits. She has written for Dynasty, the remake Dynasty, the Lethal Weapon TV show, Rain, which was about Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth I was in it, but it's technically about Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
She wrote for Star-Crossed, which I think was that Shonda Rhimes show about after Romeo and Juliet died. Private Practice, which was also Shonda Rhimes. I mean, if you want to write in TV, you can do much worse than writing for Shonda Rhimes. Life Unexpected, Life on Mars, One Tree Hill, Pepper Dennis, and Las Vegas is her writing credits going back to 2002.
Right.
So, you know, she's worked consistently since 2002, albeit all on television, which, I mean, granted, is a different beast in terms of writing and process than writing a feature script. But, I mean, if you want to lay experience back to back in terms of, like, who's, like, the more published author.
But even like a $700,000 like disparity between them, that seems a little bit excessive.
Oh, of course.
Regardless of like the credentials they both have.
It should be reversed, because it does seem like, in terms of putting your stuff on screen,
right,
she seems to be able to, she does have that experience. And it's like you were getting at too, it's like, is there any way you could sit down and say, okay, show me where Chiarelli wrote, like the portions Chiarelli is responsible for, and show me the parts that Lim is responsible for.
Yeah, I think paying the two different sums seems inherently kind of weird to begin with.
Right, but yeah.
I guess maybe I'm not in that position. I don't see those kind of deals. So.
Right.
But I also do kind of feel like every project is different too. So it's like, regardless, like, I don't think it's fair necessarily to say, well, I've been working this much more than you have, therefore I inherently, before we even put pen to paper, deserve more than you.
Right.
I think it's like we're starting with a clean slate, and whoever kind of, I don't know. It's a very interesting question about how to divvy up the payment of co-writers or writers.
Right.
I actually don't, I don't know. It just seems like it should be negotiated on the terms of that particular project.
Yeah. And I mean, coming off of a sequel situation too, you know, how did they work together in doing part one, and who like maybe delivered, you know, and those were presumably be decisions or that like the producers and the director would be privy to. It's like, well, why are we paying Adele $100,000 and this other guy $800,000? Like, did she do like 1/8 of the work, or did she, you know, and at that point, are you just saying to yourself, is the reason we have an Asian American woman co-writing this thing is because we can say, hey, look, it speaks to the Asian experience, and we know because we have an Asian person who wrote the screenplay.
That's entirely possible. It's also not entirely out of the reason or out of the realm of reason that they just straight up like are unfairly paying the guy more.
Yeah.
And it's that simple.
As standard operating procedure, yeah.
I don't know if it is that way. I kind of doubt it, but it's entirely possible. I don't know.
Well, we'll have to leave our unanswered questions here. We're going to take a quick musical break and then come back and talk about merging media conglomerates, because that's where we are now. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU.
Moments away from making up again. Hey, moments.
And that was some submarines. The wake up song. I thought, you know, we're going to go to space later, so we'll play some submarines.
Now I see what you did there. Interesting.
I'm not a DJ. Moving on. So there was an interesting detail published in an excerpt of Bob Iger's new book. If you don't know Bob Iger, he is the CEO of the Walt Disney Company, and I think that's a position he's had since 2007. So pretty much the Disney we know today is the invention of Bob Iger.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. So acquiring Marvel, acquiring Lucasfilm, acquiring Pixar, that's all him. And in case Disney already isn't big enough, he suggests in his new book that if Steve Jobs had lived, Apple and Disney would have merged. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
I mean, like, it's obviously just speculation. Like, how right. can you say what a dead man was or going to or not going to do? It's like if I was like, if I met Anna Kendrick, we would have seriously spoken about the possibility of marriage. But that doesn't say whether she would have said yes or no.
True, but you weren't acquainted with Anna Kendrick. Bob Iger and Steve Jobs were acquainted. And apparently, because Pixar was owned by Steve Jobs, and so Bob Iger bought Pixar from Steve Jobs.
Right.
And apparently, it was Jobs who vouched for Iger when Disney went into negotiations with Marvel. So it's not outside the realm of possibility that they could have come to terms.
But even then, what does that mean?
Right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, because like Apple is a $1 trillion company.
Right.
And so like buying Disney, as massive as Disney is, would still be like chump change. And analysts speculated, like people who know money and stuff, that Apple could have made like basically $200 billion extra. I mean, $200
billion. Starting to sound like Dr. Evil here.
I know, right?
$200 billion.
I mean, you know, $200 billion when you already have a trillion, you know, yeah. it's like finding a, it's like for us finding a $20 bill in our jacket. But
right.
It's not small potatoes too, and some of the people who again know money that I was reading were saying that, you know, all this, you know, the hype and stuff about Disney Plus, the new Disney streaming service, and Apple has its own streaming service coming out. Like these are still kind of like going to be basically boutique operators when you compare them to like Netflix or even something smaller than Netflix like Prime. Whereas if you had Apple and Disney merge, that would be real competition for Netflix, because what would that company do? Well, I have an Apple computer in front of me. I have an Apple phone in my pocket. Mm-hmm. I have an Apple tablet at home. Do you think that
you
all
have
of
an
those
Apple in your lunch bag?
Maybe I do. But do you think that Apple owning Disney would simply not take that opportunity to say, hey, we're going to put Disney Plus in all of our Apple products, and you're going to be able to, we're going to shove Disney so far down your access you can't possibly ignore it.
Is it also possible that Steve Jobs would have known like what was happening and would have been like, no, let's not not impose ourselves that far onto people?
It's possible, but remember Steve Jobs was like the vertical integration guy, where it's like you get everything in one thing and you don't need to add anything because we're Apple and we're already going to give you everything, including your entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, like Jobs was very much about that theory. Like I imagine that not a lot about the Steve Jobs movie is necessarily accurate to history, but I mean, it is a well-known fact that he was kind of a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
And if it, you know, he wanted Apple stuff and he wanted Apple to be the main player. He did not want, you know, the other guys to be like IBM and all the others to, you know, be able to, he wanted to compete with them. And right now the main competitor for all this streaming stuff is Netflix. Everyone is coming for Netflix's lunch, and it remains to be seen if you can knock Netflix off the perch, especially when it seems like everybody's starting a streaming service. But Netflix is still the number one streaming service in the world, and it's actually like the brand name. It's like the Xerox of streaming.
Yeah. It's like the Kleenex of streaming services.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Apple would have done their own thing with Steve Jobs, their own streaming service without Disney.
It's possible. I mean, it's possible he could. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs was very much ahead of the game in terms of... like the computer industry caught up with him,
right?
In terms of like ease of use and design and all that, it is possible that he could have come up with something different on his own.
But like, it is kind of a different beast. It is kind of a different wheelhouse. I feel like streaming services as opposed to
like
computer building. I don't know.
It could be. I mean, because Steve Jobs was very much about, like, ease of access. Like, he didn't invent the internet, but he certainly helped make it easier to get online with the first iMac. He didn't invent music downloads, but he made it easier to access music and make sure the artists were paid by creating iTunes and the iPod.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
So it's an interesting question where how somebody like Steve Jobs might have seen the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he might have also seen Netflix dominance and felt the need to attack that. And he might have done that by looking to basically do what Disney's done, which is to start enveloping other things so that then you have the content to compete and you don't have to worry about licensing other things in the same way that Netflix does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it almost does sound like a Jobsian idea. But, you know, still... I think the bigger question is lost. Like, how big can something like a Disney or an Apple get before people eventually get fed up?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we haven't really dealt with yet. And then that comes out of the Fox merger with Disney, too, that everyone got, like, hyped up like JoJo the Circus Boy about, yes, we're going to finally have X-Men versus Avengers. And it's like, okay, well... You're not going to get a Logan anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get as many Ad Astras.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no matter how we may feel about Ad Astra, stay tuned.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody's focused on what you gain in the conglomeratization of the media, and not everyone's so interested in what's lost. And what's lost could be arguably more valuable. But it's an interesting thought exercise for sure.
Yes. Yeah.
I
don't know. We'll have to get Aaron Sorkin to write that script. that fictional scenario, I think.
What if we merged?
Yep. Yeah.
It's interesting about Sorkin because he's like done like the two like kind of definitive like computer age biopics, but he's like someone who kind of hates computers.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, but the themes of like betrayal and trying to,
yeah,
you know, the underdog kind of trying to reach the top kind of fit his wheelhouse very nicely, though.
Yeah, I think so. Also fitting the wheelhouse nicely is remaking stuff.
Is it? Well, whose wheelhouse?
I don't know, Hollywood power guys.
Okay.
So, there are lots of remake news this week. The biggest one, I guess, is Princess Bride, which has made a lot of waves. You know, the internet seems in unanimous agreement that it's a bad idea.
Yep. I will piggyback on that sentiment.
It's amazing to me that someone would float that, though. And it seemed like a humble brag from the Sony executive. It was like, you know what? If we wanted to remake Princess Bride, you should see some of the people we got lined up to do it. and everyone was like, no. No, thank you. It just seems like one of those things where... I'm not someone who's like universally against remakes at all.
Yeah.
But you got to have a good reason. Like, you got to know like how to like make it different, or you got to have like a legitimate reason to remake it and make it different and why it's going to speak to audiences now.
Mm-hmm.
In a different way than...
which is what Disney is discovering... people are not responding to. It's like, why are they doing these live action remakes of all of these animated movies? Is it because there's an actual artistic angle by doing them live action? Or is it because you are actually trying to just
make money?
Make money, yeah. I think that's
it's a formula that's working.
yeah.
But I mean, it's what's interesting about those is that the straight up, like almost shot for shot remakes do better than the ones where they're trying to like do the new twist. Like I'm very interested to see how the Maleficent sequel turns out. Like if people like race out to see that.
Well, they also have the Mulan live action coming out,
which will be another interesting example because they're actually trying to broaden that and make it more inclusive and make it like ethnically relevant, although there's been already some controversy about that. But I remember watching the Mulan trailer, and if I didn't know it was the Mulan trailer, I would not have thought it was the live action remake of Mulan coming from Disney. Whereas you watch the Aladdin trailer and you get it because you've seen it before.
Right.
And the Lion King trailer for that matter. So no to Princess Bride remake. They're also remaking The Fugitive for Quibi, of all places.
Wasn't there already a show like prior to the Harrison Ford movie?
Yes, it was based on a show from the 1960s.
True, okay. So then the movie, and now they want to redo that?
Actually, they had a TV version remake of The Fugitive, and I think it was around 2000.
Right, okay.
Where I think it was like Tim Daly as Richard Kimball and McKelly Williamson. I might have got his first name wrong. He played Bubba in Forrest Gump.
Right, okay.
As Gerard. But I mean, it's interesting. I will admit it's interesting casting because it's Boyd Holbrook as the fugitive. They're not going with Richard Kimball and Gerard. They're going with like new names, which whatever. But Boyd Holbrook is the fugitive and Kiefer Sutherland is the guy chasing him. I can only imagine that Kiefer Sutherland is just basically going to do a version of Jack Bauer.
Yeah, so these are TV shows?
Yeah, this is the okay. It's going to be on Quibi.
Right.
Which I believe your boy Soderbergh's involved with.
Quibi?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's like this, it's going to be like a streaming channel and it's going to be designed for like short videos.
Oh, okay. So I don't need to worry about it then.
From the sounds of it, nobody's going to worry about it. Although they have like they have like a show from Anna Kendrick and Spielberg's working on a show for it. And then there's going to be like a weird show where Christoph Waltz is going to be hunting Liam Hemsworth, like, like hunting.
Which, what is he in his boxers in the jungle or like, what is the context surrounding that?
I don't know, but I'm kind of intrigued by the idea of like,
I think Christoph Tarantino Waltz should direct that too.
Oh yeah, I'd love to see that. Like just Christoph Waltz is like Van Pelt in Jumanji. Yeah, hunting Liam Hemsworth, who is good in nothing. Sorry, Liam.
Tell us how you really feel,
I have not been impressed.
Here's the thing. I think as much as people say, oh, I don't want this, they still flock to all of that stuff. So I think the problem is both the studio, they've gotten carried away with these remakes by overestimating how much people want them.
Right.
And consumers by consuming them way too much. And also people like Kiefer Sutherland, I think, are to blame as well for like choosing to star in these things.
He's got to eat.
So what? He can choose his projects. He can turn down The Fugitive and still be okay.
You know who can't choose their projects? Okay,
Mehna Masood can't turn down Aladdin and still be okay.
Well, that's fair. But you know who can't turn down projects? Mario Lopez and Elizabeth Berkley, who are going to be in the Saved by the Bell reboot. Or Soleil Moon Frye, who's going to be grown-up Punky Brewster.
No way. Come on. We might as well just bring back Neil Patrick Harris for the Doogie Howser reboot as well. Or are you
I think that's a check from the estate of Stephen Bochco. It is getting, because another one of the things that was announced was like a remake of Battlestar Galactica from Sam Ismaili, who created Mr. Robot. Right.
So that might be decent.
I mean, that would be the only reason to watch it, but I mean, Battlestar Galactica was remade pretty damn well,
yeah,
like 15 years ago.
Yeah. And this is a man that, you know, has no problem like writing original content,
yeah,
with Mr. Robot, obviously. This is a man that had a script on the Blacklist, an original script prior to that, that got some huge attention. So it's like, I don't get it, man.
I don't get it either. I don't
get it. Is it just easy? Is it just easy?
Well, I mean, it's cheap and easy, but you're right. It does seem like...
Like, if I was an A-list director,
yeah,
there might be some things that I would reboot. But, like, things that are bad that have the potential to be good.
Right.
I would not remake West Side Story, which already won 10 Academy Awards, and try and improve on that.
Right.
I don't see how the time and the effort will
pay
off.
You're right. I mean, it's like a codependent relationship where, you know, it's like drug dealer and drug user where, you know, the studios are the pusher. We know we don't want to take this drug, but we've become like addicted to it. Like,
yeah,
it's like nostalgia, I guess, is maybe the drug.
Mm-hmm.
We want to recapture that sense of, you know, watching Aladdin for the first time, even if it's watching a less than version with, you know, that's basically the same story with all the same beats. But
how dare you, sir?
I know. We're going to talk about
that
a Richard
DJ Khaled remix was amazing.
Well, you can tell him when he gets here.
Right.
We're going to take a
I'm
quick
kidding,
break
by the
and
way.
Then come back with speaking of originality, we're going to talk about Ad Astra.
Right.
You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
It's why they love you, how they love you. The rest is just for kicks, kicks, kicks. Let's roll out now. Power up the sand.
Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
General.
This is Lieutenant General Rivas, Director of U.S. Spacecom Special Ops.
Sir.
I need you.
Adjutant General Vogel, Head
Major.
Of Security.
Ma'am.
They flew all the way in from Virginia just last night just to see you.
Well, thank you.
Your profile is certainly very impressive. You've done exceptionally well on all the assessment tests, basic combat, space training. We have something of a highly classified nature to show you.
Major, what can you tell us about the LIMA project?
First manned expedition to the outer solar system, sir. Some 29 years ago.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission. No data was ever recovered. Deep space missions were halted after that.
Roy, we have something that might come as quite a shock to you. We believe your father is still alive.
And that was a clip from Ad Astra. It's a new film from James Gray, and it stars Brad Pitt, Tommy Lee Jones, Ruth Negga, and Donald Sutherland.
Brad Pitt having quite a year.
Yeah, no, he's... I don't think he's the problem here.
No. This was kind of boring. It's kind of like hard to get through, actually.
I didn't think I found it boring. I think I was with it until about halfway through.
Yeah, I totally agree, actually. He totally had me for the first, you're right, for the first like quarter, right?
Mm.
There's this amazing like free fall sequence with like Brad Pitt on this like space station.
Do not see this movie if you're susceptible to vertigo.
Yes, but it's incredibly well shot.
Yeah.
There's some like shootout on the moon and it's like he totally had me. And then it comes to a grinding halt with this absurd mission to find Tommy Lee Jones. and James Gray is a director that I respect enormously, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
This is one of the few, like, great American directors that's still doing, like, great original, like, filmmaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think an inspiration for young filmmakers, actually, his story, right? How he was 25 years old. He did a very low-budget film called Little Odessa. Didn't really, like, get that much big studio traction, right? But
mm-hmm.
Brad Pitt was obviously, like, a huge fan and called him up. on the phone, and they always vowed to like do a movie together. They were going to do Lost City of Z together, but at the time Brad Pitt said he didn't want to like go venturing out in the jungle. That just wasn't like a part of his
he had some issues at the time.
So I think having Charlie Hunnam lead that movie actually kind of hurt its box office kind of potential, actually.
Charlie Hunnam's a very specific talent,
Otherwise, that movie was absolutely fantastic, but I'm starting to notice like kind of a problem with all of his movies, which is that they're kind of light on story or weak on story and very beautifully shot and directed.
It is beautiful. It is a great looking movie, and it's very impressive because this is like more mid range budget than big budget.
Right.
So it's an incredibly impressive movie from a technical perspective, and yeah, that moon chase. Where a lot of it seemed, was from Brad Pitt's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It was his POV, you have to like kind of really pay attention because you can see like his reflection. It's like him looking through the space helmet, and you can see his reflection in the helmet as he's looking around and seeing the pirates of the moon, which is like one of the very first Futurama gags,
right?
That they're being chased by moon pirates, and it's just a beautiful sequence. It's
almost like a bit of Mad Max Fury Road, like,
oh yeah,
tossed in there.
Absolutely, it's great to watch. But the movie, I think, is fairly smart, and it's very good at its world building, I think, until it gets to Mars, and then there's a this is kind of getting into spoilers, but it's about how his father is went to Neptune leading this long range exploration mission. His father's still alive, and there's these pulses that are keep hitting the rest of the solar system with that create these blackouts, which, I mean, you know, when you're in space, like having a blackout on your space station is really, really dangerous. And so they're trying to connect him to his father, and he only gets so far to Mars before the Space Force takes over. And there's a sequence where he tries to sneak on the rocket that's going out towards Neptune to confront his father. And everybody in that sequence just suddenly becomes completely dumb. They do dumb things that are purely about moving the plot forward.
Yeah.
And they don't act like how you would imagine like smart people being smart astronauts would act.
Right.
Like getting out of your seat during a launch sequence.
Right, yeah.
It's just it immediately makes the film much stupider than it wants to be. And it's purely in service of the plot.
Well, that's my problem, right? Like, that whole hook with Tommy Lee Jones, that's just like a carrot on a stick to drag the plot along, right? Yeah. And then, I don't want to give it away, but I will say that whether or not he does finally find Tommy Lee Jones, the whole thing is just absurd and quick and lazy and quick. Yeah. And just an excuse to, like you said, just keep it going, right?
And it's
even
never,
though there's no story left. And it's like, you've watched this movie and you think, and by the way, I hate doing this, right? I hate doing this to good, talented filmmakers who are trying to, like, make adult movies for adults, right? Like,
we want to watch good movies, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like but I'm sorry, you cannot, like, all of the critical consensus on this is like it's really good because it's visually good, but the story is kind of lacking. It's like, I'm sorry, man, like that's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why, you know, we've already proven with this space genre that you can do both, right? Like, it's like, even something like 2001, kind of this almost meandering kind of pace, right?
Right.
But it doesn't need to, like, hook you with this like you said, this MacGuffin at the end of the road.
It doesn't need to browbeat you with the metaphor either. And there's so many sequences. There's a scene where he's trying to get to the rocket on Mars, but he has to, like, for some reason, traverse this tunnel under the surface of Mars that's like filled with water.
Yeah.
And he's like moving along on like this string as he's moving along the tunnel, and it kind of, because it's dark and there's like particulate in the water, and it's sort of like, it looks like he's moving through space.
Yeah.
Because he's like kind of floating there and shimmying along, and it's like, we get it. It's dark. He's looking for light at the end of the tunnel. Thanks.
It's so obvious that James Gray puts all of his time, energy, and resources into like the making of the film, and very little into the actual like script. There are also these little flashbacks with like Liv Tyler.
Oh my God.
She doesn't say anything. I don't think she has like any speaking
roles. She has
roles.
One line.
Okay, she has one line one in the line. Movie. But they're like these intermittent little like flashbacks of Liv Tyler, and we're supposed to kind of, I guess, connect the dots that their relationship went sour. And it's like, no, man, this is so lazy. And
well, he also keeps flashing back to her, even though I think there's that one point where he explicitly says like he doesn't care about his relationships on Earth.
Yes. So why? And I think that's part of what the movie is trying to like get at. It's like he's kind of exiling himself from the problems on Earth,
right,
by going into space, kind of thing. And Tommy Lee Jones kind of like has already kind of succumbed to this thing, I guess. Like the whole thing reminded me very much of Apocalypse Now in space, where it's like Colonel Kurtz is.
Right.
Tommy Lee Jones, and he's gone crazy, and Brad Pitt's like going after him, kind of getting sidetracked along the way.
Yeah.
There's also this like exact same sequence as the boat sequence, where there's like the little puppy on the tugboat in Apocalypse Now. There's like this Mayday, and they go, right, to investigate the ship, and there's stuff happening on the ship, and it has nothing to do with anything, but it's just a little distraction from the plot. And
yeah, there's a very Heart of Darkness vibe to it.
And it needed the Heart of Darkness structure, though. Like, it needed Brad Pitt going somewhere as he was going further into space. Instead, he remains the same flat character, and he doesn't learn anything. He doesn't change. He doesn't alter as a character in any way, shape, or form. Mm. And for me, the concept of loneliness, like exploring loneliness through film, is best done through like stuff like Taxi Driver, where it's like loneliness in a big city, right? Like, yeah, that is real loneliness for me. Everyone, right, can imagine the kind of loneliness being alone in space, but yeah, being alone in Times Square, that's a different kind of loneliness, right. I think a more interesting kind of loneliness to explore.
Right. It's my problem is that it tries to have it both ways, where it tries to be sort of meandering and contemplative, but it's, there are two
and the
levels
slam
of,
bang like,
right,
Mad Max on the moon.
There are two levels of narration to this. There's, right, like a voiceover, and then there's like he's constantly having to like do some sort of diagnostic on himself, on his psychological.
Oh, the voiceover
condition
is so bad. It's,
yeah,
like it's like a Terrence Malick like ripoff, where it's just like vague sentences,
right,
that are supposed to like mean something, like, "Father, like, where are you?" And we're supposed to like interpret it as like, oh, that's so profound, but it's not.
Right, but I mean, the problem is that there's two levels of it too. They could have, like, if you wanted to have like a narration device, they built that in with this diagnostic sequence where he has,
right,
to tell the computer how he feels and how much sleep,
yeah,
he's gotten.
Yeah.
But then they have another level of narration on top of that. And the thing about 2001, which I think this film kind of wants to be, is that there is no narration in 2001. You have to figure stuff out for yourself.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
And if James Gray was like making 2001, I'm sitting there like picturing like the sequence where Dave Bowman is like going through the light tunnel, and he's like, where am I going?
Yeah.
What is happening?
What is my soul pulling me towards?
Am I a star child?
Yeah,
now?
Yeah.
What is happening to me? What is that block? Why is this Lego here?
But even that whole HAL 9000 sequence happens,
yeah,
like at the last third of the movie. There's no kind of like build up to it. It's like it occurs kind of almost as its own segment.
And HAL has an arc.
So it's like, yeah, exactly, right? And like, how haunting is that when he's kind of being disconnected and he's singing that Daisy song, and,
right,
it's like something very, very interesting. But I understand this film is trying to do something different, but it's also not, like you said. It's,
yeah,
also clearly trying to like
it wants
extract
to,
some of those themes.
It wants to be 2001, but it wants to be Gravity 2, the Alfonso Cuarón movie.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of like the two directions when you want to do like these serious space movies, where it's something reflective and contemplative, and then you have Gravity, which is big and bombastic and filled with set pieces. Yeah. And James Gray's trying to marry the two, and they don't necessarily go together. Although there is, I think there is a version of this movie that is probably tighter, and it probably can do the things that James Gray wanted to do, but I think he makes a number of bad decisions.
And it reminds me of Steve McQueen early in his career, actually. He would make these very beautiful, very poetic, very wonderful, like, films, right? Like Hunger and Shame, things that were very kind of like slow and kind of contemplative. But the scripts were always kind of not really there. And then he finally teams up with John Ridley, who is like an extraordinary screenwriter, very accomplished screenwriter, and they make an absolute masterpiece. He makes the best thing of his career. I think that's what James Gray needs at this point. He needs to team up with a guy who really knows how to write a script.
I'm not sure I agree about...
Or a woman, actually.
I'm not sure I agree about Shame, because there's a lot of sequences in Shame where, and maybe this has to do with Michael Fassbender, where you really kind of get involved in sort of, like, you know what this guy's problems are, but you're also, like, really wondering, like, how he's working through them. Can he overcome them? Is he just going to give in to his, right, like, desires again?
And I don't think the movie, like, or the script explored that as well as, like, a really good screenwriter, like, would be able to explore that.
Right, you have to be, like, really, I think, and this is maybe a difference between James Gray and Steve McQueen, is, like, you really have to be working actor and director to get the actor to where you want to him to be in order to tell a story, because the screenplay is absent those details for a reason. Those are the scenes where the actor and the director fill in those details.
Yep.
And as you said, it seems that James Gray is more preoccupied with the technical side, which he seems very adept at, but there is
I'm only harsh on him because I know that he could do so much better, right? Like, it's just like the ending of this is so lazy. It's like, come on, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, go back, take some care. Or maybe he really just doesn't know, like, how to tie it all together. But either way, it's the directing is still, like, very good. And I still highly recommend people check out The Lost City of Z. And even The Immigrant, right, with Marion Cotillard. I think he directed that as well. That's fantastic.
Yeah. The message, I think, at the end of the movie, I think, is important. That there's... It didn't go in the direction I thought it would.
No.
With aliens and things. But there's a message at the end of the movie. And it's funny because I do kind of glom onto, like, these messages. And Tomorrowland is another example. May not necessarily be of the same type as Ad Astra. But, you know, they're both movies where it's like, I think there's something very potent about the message. Mm-hmm. There's just something in the process that it's delivered in, like, the worst possible way, so that by the time you get the message, you've been bombarded with weird character moments, missed opportunities, and you're kind of not really focused on what the final message is going to be. You're just kind of at the point where you're like, oh, let's just get out of here.
And the Ruth Negga character is so, like, so lazy, man. It's like... Yeah. She's so just wasted. Such exposition, just explains her whole backstory, and then conveniently just helps Brad Pitt. And at that point, I was like, give me a break.
She's done. She's so wasted. She's such an interesting performer.
I know. Yeah, she is.
Donald Sutherland, too. Like, Donald Sutherland, like, yeah, he has this kind of, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi quality, which is kind of weird to say.
There's even, like, a really cringy moment, too, where he's, like, kind of injured and he's telling Brad Pitt, like, go, just go, and it's that was kind of cringy and out of place.
I think that was, like, the first warning sign for me, because I did like the dynamic between those characters, and, like, I was thinking, like, okay, what is the Donald Sutherland character hiding? Turns out he wasn't hiding very much.
It's just
another tease that goes nowhere, which is a shame.
It's funny. Peter Farrelly was talking about Bottle Rocket and how kind of abruptly the story takes a turn, right? Mm-hmm. I forget which character. I think it's Owen Owen Wilson's character. I think he falls in love with the maid or whatever at the motel. And he was talking about how fun like that process is of finding the story kind of as you're going along. But I'm actually the total opposite. I hate that stuff. I hate when you are just kind of, oh, what if we go in this direction? And what if we go in that direction? It's like, know your story. And like, you can do that. I agree for like the first draft, but then go back and like fix it up and make it make sense and make it work and make it tie together.
I take it you're not a fan of My Girl.
No. No, that's correct.
Macaulay dies. Spoiler alert. Anyway.
Spoiler alert.
That we'll have to leave that there with Macaulay dies, unfortunately. We hope you liked our show because this is the end of our show. And you can We are blasting off. And you can blast off again. You can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. We're also on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. Vince, where can people find you for more space adventures?
On Twitter, at VMassin5.
All right, and I'll be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. There's an election going on, you know. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.